This is the Land and Legacy Podcast, brought to you by Whitetail Properties Real Estate. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye. This is your weekly resource for habitat management, wildlife management, and recreational real estate. We hope you guys enjoy the show.
Do you guys know your deer herd inside and out? Are trail cameras telling you everything you need to know about it? Well, possibly not, but we've got an option for you. We're teamed up with Midwest Deer Surveys, Jack Hudson, and we're putting together a new service option for you where Jack comes and flies and does a thermal drone survey, and then the team here at Land and Legacy dissects it all, analyzes all that information that was gathered through the survey, puts it all together in a video and a report, and sends it back to you and says, hey, here's your herd survey, here's your analysis, here's your population dynamics, here's what your harvest recommendation should be. But on top of that, we're really going to dissect and look at why deer are using what they're using, given those time frames in which the survey was conducted, the slope aspects, the cover types, the fact that there might be lacking cover, why they're doing what they're doing. We dive into all that and really break down what the survey showed. Not just, hey, you have X amount of deer and here's where they're at, but why. We really want to share that knowledge with you guys. So if you're looking for more in-depth understanding of your deer herd and harvest objectives, contact us. Let us know. You can go to a website, www.landlegacy.tv, click on the consulting tab, and you will find a section at the bottom of the page to send us a note, an inquiry, and we will get with you on what that looks like from a cost standpoint, so you can get a thermal survey and analysis of that survey done by the team here at Land and Legacy. And we're excited to offer this, guys. It's new for us. But if you want to know more about your property and the deer herd that's using it, contact us. Let us know. We're here to help.
Welcome back. Another Land and Legacy podcast.
That's right.
We are once again in the great state of Illinois at the Farm Progress Show 2025. We're here with Alex from Whitetail Properties. This is part two, but a totally different topic than we covered the last time.
Right.
That you probably heard last week. We are sitting here in the John Deere booth getting ready to talk food plots.
Yes.
And conversion of areas for increasing the deer use on your property. Now, we spent the whole first podcast talking about different ways to incorporate more income on the farm, different land use, collaborating with farmers to bring in additional income through crops, leasing, things like that. This one, we're going to talk about different forms of food plots, different ways to convert and plant them on your farm.
Which, thankfully, we have the food plot expert, too, with us. Alex
yes.
is a wealth of knowledge. Yeah, no. You,
where's he at?
You.
I didn't see. I haven't seen him. What?
The other Alex.
Yeah, the other one.
Alex, probably gonna, speak over Adam and I with this, yep. But I'm glad that you're with us here. And we actually just came off of food plot week for Whitetail Properties as well. That was last week, but now it is mid to late August here. And this is probably coming out now early to mid-September, and yep. What a time for food plots. And what is neat about this podcast is we're going to have the ability to talk about a lot of different conversion opportunities and the equipment that's going to be necessary or that we would recommend have someone utilize to make a fallow field a food plot or an ag field a food plot or timber, right, to food plot and or a landing, a log landing, converting it into a food plot. There's a lot of different
scenarios.
I feel
a little intimidated, to be honest with you, right now, as we sit here and talk about food plots, converting a log landing, and there's a monster combine across.
15-year-old combine.
Yeah.
The head on that thing. Yeah.
Well, the thought crossed my mind, too. But in the nature of multi-use farms, right,
I think
one of the big things that we can talk about and get excited about that we're seeing more interest in across the board, across the country, is – it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. You can have production yes. ground, tillable farmland for revenue and income while still planting food in key areas and certain areas to benefit wildlife and enjoy the fall hunting season as well. For
That's
a lot of
right.
producers and growers, you can leverage both of that. And Matt, you're exactly right. We are. It is that time of the year.
It is. We are
and if you're like me, Well, and this is another, I won't get ahead of ourselves here, but if you're like me, constantly behind and not getting planted when I should be.
You live your life 2 weeks late.
And timing rains and living my life 2 weeks late and struggling with all of that.
Have you seen that reel? Not to get sidetracked, goes right on that. And it says, it's a guy's voice, and he says, God put you on this earth to do a certain amount of things, and I'm so far behind, I'm never going to die.
That's true. There is truth in that.
And
man.
Every food plotter said amen.
Amen. Yeah. But it is that time of year. It's time to get seed in the ground. Fall annuals, it is ready to go, and I know you guys have a wealth of knowledge. And we're going to, not getting too far ahead of ourselves, but we're going to dispel some stuff. One of the big things that I've learned from you guys, and we've continued to talk about, especially when it comes to food plots, is timing.
Sure.
Right? And I lived for so long thinking, like, gosh, you've got this 2 week window and you've got to plant now, and this is the seed type you have to plant here now. And watching you boys just kind of look at me and chuckle from time to time, be like, hey, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
So if you're like me listening, if you're like me and you're constantly behind and you're always worried about your planting windows,
yep.
I think you guys are gonna bring some gospel today. It's gonna be good.
Outside of the dead of winter, you can almost always plant something.
That's right.
Correct. And that's what I think is really a lot of this message is, you know, we can convert, you know, a lot of things into a food plot. What are the steps? But we're going to break down too just the different months that you should be planting and considering planting different crops. And if that fails, right, what's plan B? What's plan C? How do you then navigate these different months and when you should be planting in and around food plots? Because I think all too often we just kind of like our last podcast we talked about, we get stuck in a box and we don't look beyond that box and look at the tools that we have and understand the variability, even in the way that we plant them, right? Can afford different opportunities, let alone seed varieties and what does better here and there and this and that. So let's break it down. I'm excited for this because honestly, I'm though too, like sidebar conversations with you and I in the truck and over the phone this the last probably month to 2 months is this pendulum. Food plots have gotten really complicated in the last 5 years, and I hope that this podcast, although we're opening up doors, right, allows for people to see that, hey, I don't have to go complicated. I don't have to go the route of this. I need this exact window to make this happen with the crimper or this and that with that spray or whatever it is. It's, hey, we can grow food. In a lot of different varieties, in a lot of different ways, and a lot of different tools to accomplish the same goal of getting quality tonnage and forage in a food plot acre.
We've gotten very complicated to the point where our window of planting is short and our seed varieties are much superior than all the others.
Yes.
And it's like, if you didn't plant this, you're a loser kind of deal.
Well, for
deer
food plots,
need that.
It's just clover and brassicas, right? Isn't that all food plot options is? That's it.
And it's like, you know, we deal with our clients where they're like, what about this? And we've gotten to the point where it's like, I don't really care if you want to try things.
Certainly.
But don't go out there thinking that, well, I have to go to this store and get this blend and that has to go everywhere. Try new things. Don't overcomplicate it. One thing I do notice that most people do is just they don't even check in on soil fertility, where it's like, well, we haven't pulled soil samples. The pH is a 5.
What's that?
The last time I did a soil test, it was 5.5, and I haven't added lime yet. But, you know, my food plots look all right. Well, what would they look like if you actually did it? And I've been guilty of this, and where it's like, well, let's actually get the pH up to where it needs to be, and let's add a little boost to it. And see what happens, and then plant at the appropriate time. It's like all the boxes where you're like, "What did you plant at the appropriate time? Did you do the soil test? I guess I should start. Did you do a soil test? Did you amend the soil? Is the pH right? Did you add some fertility there? Did you plant a blend at the right time? Was the
did you keep the weeds out? What was the deer browse like? Because really, that wasn't an unsuccessful food plot. They just ate it all.
Ate the fire out of it.
Oh, you don't have a utilization cage to even know that.
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting. Well, it wasn't a failure. It was just the fact you failed to harvest enough deer, right, in the past years, and you don't have a balance of forage production and antlerless deer. You're out of whack. So let's get there. But so first scenario to break down is essentially a log landing, right? A lot of people have them. A lot of people try and convert them into food plots. A lot of people do it unsuccessfully. But Adam, break down log landing to a food plot. What are some of those steps that you would take knowing we have heavy compaction?
Yeah.
We've got abuse of that land. Just
a lot
oil,
of times you don't even see the cleanup happen. It's just you see a lot of, you know, there's coal logs laying on the side.
Yep.
There's a bunch of treetops still laying there. And you're like, oh, my gosh. The biggest thing is getting that debris off there. If there's heavy mulch loads, try to burn as much as you can and get that woody debris off of that site. If you need to, use a dozer or use a skid steer to clean it off and get it slicked up. Of course, the compaction is not going to happen with your skid steer. It already happened with the logging, with the loggers and all their
equipment. Skidders, the fella buncher, the log truck itself.
Correct.
Being loaded 80,000 pounds.
Your biggest goal is to get that cleaned up. And I would always say this to landowners, like, if it's – those chances are there was ruts there. So get a disc out, get some sort of equipment to work that soil up.
This is where deeper tillage makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. You may have to get a root ripper out and just rip that up and get it broken up to the point where you can now go back. Now, appropriate timing is there. I wouldn't advise that in the middle of July when it's hot.
Certainly.
And you're like, oh, yeah, well, we got all that soil turnover. It's like, yeah, that was not.
That's baking.
Do that in August or do that in September and then plant a lot of immediately go in and plant some of your whatever choice. I would rather you use a lot of radishes.
Deep-rooted, taproot situations.
Yep, and then even some cereal rye, something that's going to get some organic matter on top to cover that soil up so it doesn't bake. This is a mistake I've made.
And bake not just during the fall, but really through the next spring
and early
summer.
And this is something I've learned the hard way where I used to, when I would convert areas to food plots, be like, well, this is a new area. I'm going to plant Roundup Ready soybeans so I can kill off all the weeds. Well, then this soil is just going to be exposed, and then I'm going to have overbrowsed soybeans. So soil is still exposed. It's baking. It's like, no, I'm going the opposite now. I'm going in to say, okay, I'm going to clean this up, and I'm going to plant a diverse blend that's going to put a lot of organic matter on top, and I can keep that soil covered. And go that route rather than immediately jumping in Roundup Ready soybeans.
Yeah. We're talk about this in the timber to food plot scenario as well. But one thing that I would caution people with when you're doing the landing zone and the cleanup is using a dozer inappropriately. I see a lot of times a lot of good topsoil, was left in there, it all gets pushed and scraped up.
Yeah.
And often as they're pushing the logs, as they're pushing the treetops, that you just see the mounds of your highest, best fertility soil.
It's sitting over there in a pile.
And you're left with clay and rocks and this and that. So, like, you have to, like, a skid steer or a larger track loader, that's going to be
not
a better
option. Not
a bladed
dozer. Correct. That's not ideal.
Something that can lift and push at the same time as opposed to just pushing and scraping across the ground. Mm. That is going to help you out a lot. And so... But oftentimes everyone just calls in, hey, who's got a dozer? Who's got a dozer? There's a better machine out there for that, especially when you're converting and doing some of these larger conversions from a landing or from a timber to a food plot itself.
What do we got to do to get Alex in one of those hats?
Oh, man, yeah, no doubt. That would be great.
I do need a corn hat for sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's not a cheesehead. You're a corn.
Yeah.
Although the headset wouldn't fit around it right now.
No.
If not, I would ask.
Yeah.
But
so on these landing zones, the biggest thing that I see is, like you said, scraping off the topsoil, what little topsoil is there, or then planting something that's not, you know, one species blend and it being over browse, and now you've just got the soil just baking.
Yep.
I think for the initial cleanup is get that debris off there, disc it up, do whatever tools you need to do tillage wise to smooth that area out and get that seed bed kind of not being the smash down hard as a rock, hard as concrete, where the skidder's rolled out and you immediately try to plant it. Clean that thing up. That's going to be your best option in getting a quality food plot.
Yeah, and I would say don't rush into a perennial.
Yeah,
either.
No.
Go some fall annuals from the organic matter side of things, but you can work yourself into a perennial base. But oftentimes, too, the landing is not large in size, like acres, right? We're talking half acre to three quarter acre in size. So those generally fit well within a perennial crop because they'll handle browse pressure. But just don't jump right into that situation too early without doing the proper, you know, mechanical needs to the heavily compacted soils and also understand that organic.
It goes back a lot to what Adam was saying about the testing too, is where that can really help determine a lot too. You mean everybody's just like, oh, well, you know, I need to go in and get some nitrogen back into the soil, so we're going to plant clover and everything like that. Well, it's like, and that may be a great decision. That may be, hey, we need to do it for the browse pressure. And it, but it may not. It's like, maybe we don't need to pour a bunch of nitrogen back into this thing. Maybe it is okay. Let's figure out a different option.
Let's build organic matter a little better than perennial clover. That, and then that leads into the next thing of timber to food plot. And I've done this a lot. My farm was, I mean, when you looked at my farm that my brother and I bought, we're talking hundreds of acres between what I own and the neighbor where it's just all
timber,
closed canopy timber. There was one little spot, about a tenth of an acre that we planted. And so when we bought it and we started doing different things, we planted or cleared out, I don't know, probably close to 12 acres of timber planted at food plots. And I've learned, like I mentioned earlier, about the cleared it, planted soybeans. And I still have food plots that are struggling because I did it incorrectly. And so I'm going to point out what you mentioned earlier too. When it comes to clearing the timber, man, it's a debated topic of what's the appropriate tool, whether you should use a excavator with a thumb and you're just going to yank them out by the roots and not really exposing the soil, or you should use a dozer. And people think, well, automatically with a dozer, it's like, oh, a six-way straight blade dozer. It's like, no, not our favorite. Our favorite is the high lift dozer or the track loader, whatever. It kind of seems like different regions call them different things, but we're talking about a dozer with a bucket and root rake teeth versus a straight blade. And the reason we don't like the excavator, speaking from a man or speaking on experience here as a man who's rode across many food plots that had excavators pull the trees out to make food plots, there's a lot of holes that don't get filled back in.
Yeah.
It may seem level, but when you're going out through there and you're hitting these little 6-inch, 10-inch dips all
over. Planting it with the drill, you feel it on the drill and the back tires.
It's terrible.
On the pressure,
and it drives you nuts. And so going with that front lift, high lift dozer.
Or if you have a excavator, that's not the only piece of equipment that's there. You come back and you float it with a different piece of equipment to smooth it all out appropriately.
Or disc it up if you've got adequate soil.
And if you're going from timber to the food plot, there's probably some marketable timber within these acres. That's where you're talking about using, getting the trees down, uprooted before they're cut and harvested.
Oh.
That is going to save a lot of time and money because then you have to bring in an excavator to dig every single stump out, depending on the stem density. That's a lot of time and that's a lot of expense. And guess what? You're not shaking out all that dirt that's in and around that root system and impacted. You have, go ahead, clear it, lay that timber out that's marketable, allow the loggers to come in, cut the logs out, and then take the stumps themselves and push them off. It's going to be way faster, cleaner, I think less disturbance, and cheaper to do it that way as opposed to cutting it completely first, then going and digging every stump with an excavator. Because that absolutely requires two pieces of equipment to get that done. But if you do it with the track loader and he's pushing, knocking, and sorting the timber for them to come back and log ahead of time, then he comes back and finishes once the logs are out.
Yeah.
Okay, now we can still just use one piece of clearing equipment, the track loader, the high lift track loader. And, all right, now we're good.
And with a little communication, right? It's like that's something that's overlooked too. Is like maybe it's a man that owns bought a property or owns a property for recreational use or whatever, and doesn't necessarily consider the maturity or the potential timber value in that site that he wants to convert to a food plot. So he just goes in with a chainsaw, starts felling trees everywhere, and then it's like, all right, then I've got to figure out how to get these things out of here. All this water.
Yep.
Hey, take a minute, ask a question, maybe get a cruise done, consult somebody or whatever. The forester or the timber guy who does the harvest will do a lot of that work for you. We'll remove those trees and say, hey, I'd really appreciate it if you kind of use your access road over here and don't cut through. Just with a little just communication and getting on the same page of that, they can make the cleanup work, what I've seen, drastically better.
Yeah,
drastically
better. And with that being said, not all operators are created equal. This is something I've learned the hard way where I hired – now looking back, the best dozer operator, the first go-around. He was a little bit more expensive than everyone.
You say dozer operator, you mean track loader operator.
Yeah. I mean, it's a dozer, a high-lift dozer. But I hired him the first go-around, and he was a little bit more, but way faster. So it all probably equaled out. And, I mean, it was just great. Well, the next time I had a food plot done, it was like, they're like 2-3 months out. I got to get this done soon, so I'll go find this other guy. Oh, I hear he's pretty good. Oh, he's actually cheaper. Well, it took him forever to clear it. And it's like, what in the world? Same machine, too. And it's like, yeah, just because that guy, that carpenter has a hammer and that one has a hammer does not mean they do the same quality.
They swing it the same. That's right.
And so keep that in mind. See if they've done food plots before, yeah, if they've cleared timber and how quick they think they can go. And it'd be, I learned that a very hard way.
And that's what's also cool, too, with the stumps, the debris that come from once you've timbered. In talking about it, you can create some closed edge feathering along the food, yeah, plot as well, yeah, and say, hey, I don't need deer coming in and out of the plot here. This is going to now make them work north to south in this plot like I want to.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
great. Also probably another good time to say, when we're talking about the pieces of equipment on site, that's, yeah, why if you have the high lift loader, you can also put in wildlife water holes all over the place really easily. Just the maneuverability of that machine can clear it, can grade it, float it, and put in a water hole, and then put the debris where it needs to go.
That's right. That is
a huge option, because now if you can control where deer are coming in and out of, as well as draw them closer with the water hole, holy cow, now we're cooking with peanut oil. That will work all day long, and with one piece of equipment, pretty phenomenal.
That's right.
Now,
yep, and like I said, if you're cleaning timber up to make a food plot, that's the big thing about what I said earlier, learning the hard way. I've learned a lot of lessons, if you can't tell, about planting and creating food plots, that we try to convey that with our clients to avoid these common mistakes. And these are not just common mistakes we hear about. We actually lived them. And it's the, okay, I took this 2-acre patch of timber on an oak hardwood in southern Missouri in the Ozarks, and now I'm going to plant it in a food plot, and it's going to be like the TV shows. It wasn't quite like that. We went to Roundup Ready soybeans first. Well, the deer overbrowse them. And so it's like, you have all this exposed soil, and then it just bakes all summer long. And then now it gets hard like a,
it's
like
caked,
concrete.
Yeah.
Can't disc it up because I'd get way too many rocks. So it's like, well, we gotta go a different route. And now it's like, if we would have just done a diverse blend, if we cleared it in the summer, then plant sedan grass, sun hemp, cow peas, all the stuff that's easy to grow, just plant that. Who cares about the weeds? Just get a lot of stuff to grow. And then if you cleared it in the fall or late summer, then plant it in a high diverse with lots of cereal rye, triticale, annual clovers, brassicas. Get those things to grow rather than going, oh, we're going to do one species that's what I want. You may not get that right out of the gate.
Everybody wants instant results.
Yeah.
And oftentimes it's we try and get there too fast, get to that end goal too fast, instead of saying, hey, this is what's best for that soil. This is what's best for that food plot. I should work my way into this, but I know that eventually when it's right, I'm going to convert that into a perennial long-term crop, or that's going to be, you know, a grain crop, whatever the case may be. It's just not timber or log landing directly into end result in most states, most cases. It's a phased in approach.
Yeah.
Now, fallow field to food plot is a little bit of a different story, because we're not taking mature forest or an older forest system and converting it right into a field. We have a field, and it could be a successional field with forbs, grasses, and some saplings and brambles.
I mean, when we say fallow field, I just immediately picture the most beautiful form of old field.
That always gets uprooted.
That gets ripped up.
That I want to keep an old field and not plant a food plot.
Yes. Yeah. We all see them. Everyone knows.
Oh,
them.
Man.
No,
look
not
at
those
it.
Acres.
It's got, you know, goldenrod, and it's got little blue stem, big blue stem. It's got some blue mist flower, whatever, you name it. New England,
got what
Aster,
it
you're like,
have.
This is perfect. And then the guy's like, I'm going to plant a food plot there. And you're like, ah. Okay.
You look around, you're like, oh, you already did. How?
Okay. Yeah, you already did plant it. Well, okay.
You left an edge or the corner of a
so, but let's just say there, you know, where there's 300 acres of that, that's
right.
Fine. We're not going
right.
to crawl over 1 acre. So
correct.
We're converting it. You know, the big thing is, depending on the time of the year, let's just assume half those plants that are growing there are already mature and they're not really going to take herbicide too well. They're already gone to seed. So let's go ahead and bush hog that down and get that thatch completely cut down short. Now let's go in, give it a little bit, see if it rebounds, starts greening up. Then you can spray it. And then it would be, let's burn it. Now we're set up. We got that removed.
Burn it with herbicide.
Yeah, burn it down with herbicide. And then if there's a bunch of thatch and you're like, depending on what the species were that were there, there's too much thatch to plant through. So then you may have to actually burn that off. Let's hope that it's not. And you can just say, we're going to leave that thatch for some organic matter, and we're gonna no-till right into this. That's a prime suspect. I see this a lot. I feel like we're talking to somebody from Michigan. Don't we have one of those here?
We might have one of those
here. Yeah.
Guilty.
Don't raise your hand too high. Where there's lots of natural, New York, Pennsylvania, prime spots where there's lots of these old field areas that get converted. And it's like, what? Well, eventually you can just snap your fingers and it goes from old field to beautiful magazine-worthy brassicas. Because that's what happens up there in that climate. You can grow some brassicas in the Great Lakes.
Starting in June and then July and August look amazing. It's like, wow. Okay. Nice, good for you guys.
And then we're down here in the Ozarks, and it's just like a struggle.
You see them brassicas in the rocks? Yeah, me
absolutely.
Too.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Up there, do the bulbs actually start in the dirt? Yeah. Because ours just grow from top. Yeah.
But that's one of the things that is oftentimes I see guys converting these with a skid steer, right?
Yeah.
And then one of the rotary cutters, the front mounted brush hog.
I see that a lot more if there's a lot of like speaking of Michigan, autumn olive or bush honeysuckle dotted through it.
In the Midwest, it's the honey locust that's dotted throughout the field.
This is the playground I really like to play in because I don't have the resources or the contacts to utilize a dozer at any high level to clear off any major area. But we're talking about conversion or clearing, something that's high stem count, old field, something like that. And you can get like a, we're looking at them earlier today right here in the John Deere, a 333 G or like a 335 P, something like that. I mean, the versatility that you can get done with one of those skid steers and the attachments, I mean, it's unbelievable. And you can, and again, there's more than one way to skin the cat, whether there's a tiller attachment on the front or you're going to do like a rotary cutter, like you said, and get everything off, let it fire, let it burn through, whatever, whatever you're going to do. I just, it's the versatility and the capabilities you have to be able to get creative with an old field situation that you want to turn into a food plot. I've been super excited about it really gets me excited because I can be like, hey, I don't have to be limited to one thing here. I can start really, really getting creative on how I want to set this up.
And that's a great thing about the skid steer itself is there's an attachment for just about everything, whether going from, converting, transforming, cutting, manipulating to then actually what you can do with the soil itself is you can use that same machine with multiple attachments and you can get to good bare dirt in a day. Less than a day. Hours.
I want to ask you guys, I mean, would you, with your clientele and your consulting work, I mean, we're hearing it a lot from like landowners and land managers we work with and even our land specialists just in their own properties or they're helping one of our, buyers or sellers with. Would you agree that a skid steer is probably the most useful and versatile equipment if you had to choose one?
Framed in that question, absolutely.
If you're having to do some clearing and cutting in roads,
shaping
making new
roads.
Food plots, shaping roads, I would say if you're going at this appropriately, buy the skid steer first. Do all that work, and then when you're done with that, then you can sell it or trade it in for a tractor and then plant your food plots.
Yeah.
That's ideal. But if you go out right out of the gate and you go buy a big, nice tractor and you're like, well, now I got to hire somebody else to come and make all the roads and make the food plots. So there's a multi-step process to make this better.
And just all the tools. The Frontier line has got an incredible amount of different varieties attached to a skid steer itself. And it's a multi-tool. It's a Swiss Army knife for a landowner.
For somebody that's not a major producer that has access to all the big equipment, somebody's looking for more of a mid-size, like an E or an R series tractor, or like I said, the 333 or the 335. On the skid steer side, it's like they're drawing so much more to that because of like I can help clear out the edges around my pond. I can clear that old field off and plant that. It truly becomes an all around property tool and storing it as much because it's just a smaller platform, right? So it's more compact. I mean, we are getting more and more feedback of the popularity of that kind of tool. Tractors are great, certainly have their place too, but somebody that's not, producing or farming full time, and they have this recreational property, or maybe it's like some type of multi-use property. It's just been unreal, the popularity of those things.
Well, and not to knock on, obviously, a no-till drill. There's a fantastic tool or a planter. But when we're talking about food plots, there's a lot of different varieties, whether they're annuals and or perennials, that in most cases can do just as good, if not better, broadcasted. And you don't need a tractor to broadcast. You can do that with UTV. You can walk it in. And so broadcasting in that planting technique is often very much overlooked from the food plot side of things. We kind of mentioned earlier, like the pendulum swung. It got like really complicated. If it's not playing with the no-till drill.
I need a no-till drill and a crimper now.
Yeah. if you're not doing that method, then are you even food plotting?
Right.
It's like the mentality. It's like, whoa. We can – I will broadcast – 60 to 70% of the food plots that I plant, in a yearly basis, easy.
Do you even food plot, bro?
I'll show you some pictures.
And that's where I love no-till drills, love them. But
great pieces of equipment.
Part of me with broadcasting brassicas, broadcasting clovers, broadcasting alfalfa, simple drags to help with that. It's like, boy, a person could go a long ways if he's got a cheap like a disc, a drag. Throw in those small seeds, and it's like if you've already got a tractor and you look around on marketplace, it's like a four-row John Deere 7000 is pretty cheap.
Yeah.
And I can put some corn in the ground and beans now.
Right.
Absolutely.
It's like you can get in the game
way cheaper with the planter than you can a drill.
I tell you what, that little four-row, that four-row stuff like you're talking about, those things are hot commodities, boy. Oh. It's hard to find those things now. People are – they're catching on.
Well,
you need to quit talking
about
it. You need to quit talking about it.
But I tell you, I
got one, don't worry.
We got two of them now.
Sure,
we got to get one of them fixed up. But, you can get any part you need. And it's like, I bought one for $1,500 and one for $1,800.
Yeah, it's
four-row, 36-inch rows. And it's like, man, I could get some brassicas growing in between those rows.
That's right.
Come July.
No question.
And it's like, wow, what are we doing here? $20,000 for a no-till drill and $2,000 for a planter, and I can get corn, and then I can do brassicas. What is happening?
I want to ask you guys back to the fallow field, because I feel like this is a setting and a situation that a lot of deer hunters and just land managers are running into, right?
Yep.
It's probably one of the most common, if not the most common, converted areas of that to a food plot. Walk me through. I just want to kind of go through a scenario here. So say. Say you're in, in this area here. We're in Illinois, Iowa, Missouri, something like that. We come across a site like that. Now, granted, I know there's variables that'll dictate a little bit here, but walk me through. So it's been a fallow field for 10 years, whatever.
Okay.
Not major trees, but maybe there's some, there's some whatever, couple few inches to whatever diameter to little saplings, whatever it might be. Take me from site assessment to... we've got an established food plot. A little bit of how you would approach that from an act, what initiative would you take in order to get me from fallow field to planted food plot?
And before we answer this, we may have slightly variance in our method, but ultimately when it comes to this, there's a couple different ways that people can do it to be successful. But ideally, first thing I'm doing, like if I'm on a property, let's say a guy shows me one, I'm going to look at a soil map. I'm just going to open up Onyx real quick and see what the soil map shows. We can do a pretty good site assessment standing there, looking around, seeing what's growing
right.
Or what the dirt looks like underneath all the vegetation. They go, okay.
It's a quick, can we plant here and be successful? Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. We're
or, good. And then the other big question is this a wet spot? You know, like, there are a lot of water that sits on this the course of the year, because then we're just wasting our time. But let's say it checks both those boxes. Yeah, soil maps looks like it's pretty good soil. Doesn't look like water sits on it all the time. Now let's get in here and figure out what we got. The next logical question is what tools are available? Not just what's the perfect scenario, but what tools are available? And let's just say it's simple tractor and a disc, and it's like, okay, well, what we're going to do is we're going to spray this area or mow it down, and then we'll spray it. And then on those little saplings, maybe we get the chainsaw out and we just cut it as low to the ground as possible and stick a little flag up being like, okay, when we come back in here, let's just not drive the tire right over this spot.
What would your herbicide application be in a typical fallow field setting?
It'd just be glyphosate 2/4 of the acre.
There you go.
Yep, I just burn it down with that. If depending on what species are there. Now, because then we're uncorking another. Let's say it's Cerisa Lespediza. Then I'm going, no, I need to spray it with MSM-60 first or Met-Met and control that first, because if I just spray Cerisa on it, I'm just top killing it. It's going to come back next year. So there's many variables here, but
yeah,
for simple
generally
terms,
talking, yeah,
I'm going to mow it down. Given that it's, let's say, late summer like now, I'm going to just mow it down, let that start greening up in a week or two, and then I'm going to spray it, glyphosate, kill that off, and then I'd probably do some tillage depending on how flat the area was, just to get it smoothed out and prepped up. And then I would plant a diverse blend. That'd be it for me.
Yeah, I'm rotary-type cutting, let it grow back, spray it, evaluate the thatch level, the loads, what I need to do there, the stumping. And yep, if I have excess, if it's been 10 years, I probably have a lot of thatch,
yeah,
especially if it hasn't been burned. So yeah, it is likely going to be important either prior to trying to disturb the soil at all to burn that dead thatch off that has been cut, burn it off, maybe let it regrow, spray it then, and then come back in and turn any type of dirt, tillage that you might need to smooth it out, and then I'm planting the seed itself.
Very good. Yep. I love that. This is,
and you can do it with a four-wheeler and attachment if you
right
need to.
Oh,
like
yeah,
the tillage
yeah
isn't necessary. You could spray it with a four-wheeler sprayer. You could broadcast it, burn it off, and then broadcast
I'm
it on there
plenty
and have
of times
great success. Yeah. Grab the tree that you cut out of the plot, that 6-foot cedar, tie a rope around it, and use that as your drag.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's very simple.
I've used pallets. I mean, we got a Gator 845M, and the thing is an absolute workhorse machine.
Yeah.
And it's like I've drug pallets to clear the thatch or to do the soil up. I've pulled. The size of a disc that those things even pull is impressive
yeah
in itself.
Right.
So I love that. The one thing I face a lot, or I've maybe questioned myself on a little bit, is how much thatch is a good moisture holder and
yep
tolerable to shade some of that off, let those young plants grow, and then how much is just there's too much thatch here, we can't do it. Where where have you guys found that variable to be of like that there's enough here to be just okay and there's too much here?
I think it totally depends on, is it thatch that's vertical or horizontal? If it's vertical, I could broadcast a ton through it and not be a problem, and eventually it's going to lay over, fall over, what have you. So like a case in point, had a fall food plot last year that allowed it to grow all the way through mid-July, sprayed it, and it had Johnson grass, it had wheat, it had rye, just a mixture of all sorts of stuff from last year as well as what grew back in this spring. I broadcasted brassicas, small-seeded brassicas. It rained, and there's brassicas absolutely everywhere through what was 4-foot tall thatch and thick. Most people would not dare broadcast through that because like, there's no way you're going to be able to get anything established underneath of that because it's just way too dense. But if it's upright, the seed falls easily between it. However, if it's all laid over and it's a mat across the ground, broadcasting is not nearly as effective in that manner. So you would have to manipulate that in some way. Burning it's going to be probably the cheapest, mm-hmm, fastest, and the easiest. Then you have your bare soils and you could go and broadcast
right
into it. Or you drill, you know, through that.
Drill it, yeah.
As long as that thatch, though, is all laid in the same way. What I think a lot of people can get issues with is they're brush hogging area, or they'll have that rotary cutter do it, and you get balls of thatch.
Mm.
You get it mixed. You get
wads or piles.
Yeah, and you get it laid in a bunch of different directions.
Right.
A drill doesn't cut through all that as good. I would rather not cut it, just spray it, and drill through it or broadcast vertical.
Next question for you guys. So I think that's awesome. You guys got us to, like, obviously assessing the site all the way to planting. On planting timing, and I know we're going to talk a little bit more about this too. I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but just in this specific scenario of the fallow field kind of situation that we've corrected, now we're going to plant. Because I struggle with this too, not so much from an understanding of how to correlate it with the rain or when that moisture is going to be there. But
yeah,
but I'm like everybody else, time. Just available time is a real is a real thing, right? So, and I know you guys have, you know, you guys have young families too. You struggle with this all the time yourselves. So, give me the rails, right? The guardrails of like, it's too early, or I absolutely wouldn't plant it here, or whatever. I guess really what I'm asking you is, how far out does a rain need to be for you to be okay with putting seed on the ground versus the 10, 12, 14-day forecast does not have a stitch of precipitation in it, I'm not putting seed down? Or are you going to go ahead and go ahead and get the seed in? And
in the spring, you're typically going to have pretty good moisture in the soil.
Moisture content in the soil.
Yeah. So you could get away with, and chances are, I mean, and not say it doesn't happen because it did 2 years ago, but you're going to have rain in the next 7 days most likely. And even if it's 10 days out, there's still enough moisture and enough moisture in the soil that you're like, okay, I can go ahead and plant this. It's going to be fine.
You're mainly looking for, is it dry enough for me to plant?
Yeah.
That's right, in the spring.
Right, yeah, springtime. Yeah.
But in the summer, like now, because I like planting brassicas in July. And for me, that's when you start looking at the forecast going, okay, what's the forecast look like? Because if, and this is something this year that I kind of visualize or put into words going, if I'm reliant on the forecast, it's got rain chances, but what I'm reliant on is the forecast to be off in a good way, meaning there's more rain that's coming than what the forecast tells me, then I'm not planting. Because it's just like, that's a gamble. That's just like hoping that it goes from 0% to 100%. Like, that's not a good case. So from July, August, September, October, November, and even, you know, there's zero rye in certain regions of listenership that you could plant in December. That's when I'm looking at it going, I need something in the forecast that tells me. And one thing we've been experimenting on is going seed soaking, where we soak the seed first in water to try to get that seed already in condition to sprout and then putting it on, because what happens a lot is going,
depending on seed coatings,
rain's coming.
I knew I should have called you guys.
Broadcasting and going, look at this. Yeah, it's out there. And we get one little bit of rain and that seed swells up and then it doesn't rain for 15. Well, guess what? That seed's not growing anymore.
No. I know. I planted oats and brassicas 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And there has not been a drop.
Oh,
and so I'm already prepared. I'm already prepared to overseed back and do it again. Yep. But it'll be very interesting. And again, I mean, there's like what you said earlier, I mean, at the beginning, there is no limit to seed selection, food plot types, things like that.
Right.
And we've been partnered with Whitetail Institute for a long, long time. And they make a very high quality science backed seed. So, I mean, I have a lot of confidence in it too. But man, nothing compete against Mother Nature. So we're going to see. And I know it's coded and all that, but it's one of those things. I was listening to everything you guys were saying, but selfishly in my mind, I was like, man, this is the situation I'm in, and I need to talk to you boys about how we fix this.
Yeah.
So,
well,
yeah.
Go ahead. I was going to say, just like tomorrow, we're supposed to get rain back home. They've been calling for it for a week.
From the 10-day forecast, it's like, next Thursday, Wednesday, Thursday,
it's
woohoo!
Like 90% to 100%. And when they say that, you know, 5 and 6 days out, I'm very confident.
Yeah,
like, hey,
you're gonna get something. Yeah.
So I broadcasted some additional seed stuff over brassicas. I did that yesterday morning before we got on the road to get up here. And, you know, now I look this morning and the storm shifted and it's gone south and we might get a tenth of an inch.
We were supposed to have, over the course of 2 days, an inch and a half of rain, and there was an 80% chance both days. Now we have a 0% chance on Wednesday and a 56% chance on Thursday for 15th of an inch.
Oof.
Not good,
nope.
Right? So luckily, though, you can split applications and when you're doing seed. Like you mentioned the July seed in Nebraska. Okay, great. I have that established
already. And even annual clovers.
And so, some annual clovers. I've had that established at this point, right? I'm just trying to make it additive to it. So I'm not going to look like I'm going to get some rain. So the wheat probably is not going to germinate. Okay, well, it's not a failure yet. I just have to wait for the next window. But also, in comparison, I've got a couple that are large perennial bases, one alfalfa field that we've had some really heavy dews. It's cooled off here, and it's coming back really strong, starting to beat out the heavy browse pressure that the field's getting. So all the chips are not in a fall annual planting. It is, hey, I want to establish the brassicas and the wheat for, you know, late season crop, but I do right now have a lot of deer coming into an alfalfa field, and it's starting to revive itself, and it's just like, that's where we get into having multiple crops. We can afford to, hey, miss a rain occasionally and say, okay, plan B, I need to pivot. I didn't get that rain. Now I'm switching from small seeded brassicas. Now we're getting into the cereal grain window. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm going to be planting. In
yeah.
Next
so
I planted
April,
stuff November 4th last year.
Yeah.
We got like 4 inches of rain November 4th last year.
Yeah, we planted a whole triticale bottom cover crop in November. So April.
I'm hunting whitetails on November 4th.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I did too, but I made a point to say, hey.
There's days where it's not worth hunting because temperatures suck. That's a good day.
Or it's pouring down rain. Let's go plant.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So
April. You know, we'll go through the months. So, like, I think historically food plot guys have always been like, well, you've got the last week of May and the first week till the first week of – or last week of April, first week of May, that's the planting window in the spring. And then the last week of August and the first week of September, that's the fall one. And it's like, no, April, you can plant corn. And if you're way down south, this podcast is irrelevant to you because you might as well be on the surface of the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Getting paired to the timing for the rest of us. But April, you can plant corn. In some southern states, you're going to be planting some soybeans. So it's really those two crops are the main ones. I don't really recommend, like, to clients that are doing, well, what about spring oats and stuff? It's like it's such a gamble for a lot of these guys that, you know, those two, corn and soybeans, prime time.
You can do like a joint vetch if you're down south as well.
Early. There you go.
It takes a long time to establish. It's small seeded, mm-hmm. but you can plant that one early as well. That's post frost dates in those regions.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So May rolls around. That's when you can get into some of these summer blends. You can still plant. You know, it might be you still do some corn. You can still do soybeans. You can really start getting into the summer blends where you might have millets and milo and buckwheat and sunflowers and cowpeas and iron clay peas and lab and you name it. I'm sure I missed one. Sun hemp, if I didn't say that.
And I like the reason for waiting on those ones is because when you have diversity, your herbicide options become very limited. So, if you're going to wait until that late May, early June timeframe, a lot of your summer weeds have already started and sprouted, and you can hit those prior to planting.
Well,
that.
And sun hemp can't take the cooler temps because it's more of an exotic anyway. So,
I don't want to rush that. I'm not in a hurry to get that established.
June, same thing. You can plant, you know, you could do beans and just hope that you get the rain. So soybeans you could still plant in June. The summer blends being a big one where, you know, if you only want to do just buckwheat or just milo, you still have time. Millets for sure, but that's when I really, when it comes to June, that's the month where I'm going to rely way more on blends going, at least of the 9 species in this blend, some of them are going to do just fine. Right. There may be a few that get overbrowsed, but I'll get something out of this. And so June to me is the blend month.
Yeah, definitely.
July rolls around. You can still do the blends. You may not get the full 10-foot growth out of them if it's got sun hemp or sedan grass in it, but you'll still get some vegetation growing. But July is the brassica month for me.
I think you really need to start evaluating when you're looking at July and saying, do I really want a warm season annual planting diverse? Or do I – because the purpose of the food plot is to create and attract deer in there during hunting season. Yes, it's to supplement forage, but really we all want to harvest deer in a food plot. So why at this point in the season, growing season, do I want to shift into warm season diverse annual – when really I need to be starting to focus on what am I going to have in there for fall and the longevity of fall and winter. That's what I really need to be preparing for. So July is kind of that transition month mentally for, brassicas, that's what I should probably be focused on versus that.
It's you're calling an audible summary every month where you just like evaluate and be ready to shift on the fly. And July is like that transition from summer or spring food plots to fall. Now it's prime time to be doing brassicas. And that rolls right into August, which beginning of the month is still brassica season and annual clover season. Weed control, getting prepped for your diverse fall blend for the latter part of August. You know, if you're in the northern states, Great Lakes, you're going to be planting those blends in the beginning part of August to mid-August. If you're in the lower Midwest, the south, you're still thinking army worms. You're still thinking, not quite there yet, probably in a drought because it's always a drought in August and September anymore. And there you go. Now you're kind of the tail end of the month. Like in Missouri, is like prime time. Get those fall blends in the ground.
That is the game.
That's when you can start looking at establishing alfalfa too.
And that's been like the traditional fall planting window, right? Like it's, yep. it's late August, very early yep. September. But that's why it's great for blends, because you can have a kind of a catch-all. Something will probably start growing, but yep. it's not ideal and perfect for brassica development, but it's also really good from a wheat standpoint, which people just like to see a lot of green stuff in a fall food plot. So it's like, it's not a bad window, but it's the real thing is the window started in July, and it's going to yeah. continue through yeah. November. Just as it's not going to be, don't go with a fall blend. Start picking out the species then before and after that are going to do the best. Mm-hmm. But as a blend standpoint, that traditional late August, early September is a great window.
That's why I started leaning on the July planting and or the brassica planting in July, because late August and September turned into being the driest months of the year.
You couldn't establish
a blend.
And it was
like, you can't get blends or seed established based on the little bit of moisture that's in the air. But there's enough dews. You're like, man, why can't we? There's dews every morning. It's cool yeah. every morning. But that's only enough to sustain already establishing plants. So if we could get brassicas up 6 inches tall by planting them in July, and then we roll into the drought of late summer, late August, and September, and we still get dews, well, they're still fine. Yeah, and that's what really made us start shifting away from those brassicas in August.
What you want to do is really try, I feel like, avoid planting, obviously, in the driest portions. No duh. But don't try and develop a root system in the driest portions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do it pre or do it post, or have perennial bases that are going to handle the drought,
yeah.
but also just be revived by dews. Yeah. Clover yeah. and alfalfa are great options.
That's definitely something that, as my food plot game has kind of evolved over time, I didn't value or factor in the dews as much, yeah. especially as the temperatures start to fall off, you know, depending on where, of course, you are in the country, but
yep.
My point is where you don't wake up at 5 a.m. and it's 80 degrees, you know, where yeah. you're yes. starting to get a little more of that cooler temp, the dews fall heavier. Man, it can really sustain. Like, it really yeah. can revive. I've noticed that a lot. So, all right, we're here at the Farm Progress Show in the John Deere booth recording this in late August. Now, when this drops, it's going to be early September. I want to get into a mindset. Okay, guys are ready to go right now. Either maybe they're a little behind. Maybe they're timing it perfectly for what they want to do.
First round didn't work.
Round didn't work.
Yeah. So I wanted to say this before we skip on, because I don't want to say it right. But back to the dews, a heavy dew can produce 1,000 gallons of water per acre. So you put 1,000 gallons of water per acre
that's
every morning
yeah.
or overnight ever on an established root system, that's definitely sustaining.
Yeah,
so,
you're in
so
survival.
Capitalize on that.
You're gonna pull through and be fine versus a lost
versus plant, you know, a fall annual blend yeah. that's sitting in dry dirt and you're not
right,
getting rain.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
So back to
September.
Yeah, early September. Now,
that's when September is when you start kind of shifting away, going like. You can plant brassicas, and if you're down south, let's say Mason-Dixon South, you can still get away with brassicas. But for most of us, like Iowa, northern Illinois, Great Lakes,
Kansas.
It's like, all right, brassicas are over now. It's cereal grain, you know, shift away. Because any brassicas I'm planting is only taking space up for something that's more fitted for that growing condition mm-hmm. in that time. So shift into cereal grains. And then you still have time for oats, wheat, triticale, barley, cereal rye. September, you still got time for all of them. So just shift into that, roughly 75 to 100 pounds to the acre.
And that's there's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing.
Like I feel like everyone wants to think, well, the more diverse that fall blend is, I don't care how diverse it is, just as long as I do have good forage in there at the right time frame.
Yeah,
yeah.
A lot of people start sacrificing and say, well, I really want that blend. Well, that window's missed. Don't think that yep. the food plot is going to be not attractive or unproductive just because you're going on a heavy percentage or at least a small grain only food plot. I promise you, if it's got tonnage, you will have deer.
And how would you know if you don't test and play with it a little bit too and try something different? Deer love diversity. They love variety. They want yep. it anyway. So
it'll be productive.
You never know what might shake out with that too. Yeah,
yeah,
I agree.
So, and then, of course, we'll say October and November, lump those together. Still the same thing. You're probably shifting away from barley oats and more into winter wheat and cereal rye.
Cereal rye.
And the latter part of that November being cereal rye, just because it can withstand that and get germinate a lot cooler temperatures than oats and wheat. So for us, that's why you look at it going from April through November, there's something you can plant.
That's a there's a playbook right there. Just like, continue to evaluate, look at weed pressure, look at, you know, the timing of the planting, look at your rains. And I spoke with a gentleman the other day, and we had this conversation yesterday driving up. It's like, I like a good food plot plan.
Mm-hmm.
And a plan is good, but oftentimes we're always given variables and curveballs. So don't be so tied to your plan that you don't think of audibles.
You miss opportunities. Yeah,
you're missing opportunities. Yeah. So you really have to look and say, okay, well, that didn't work, or that failed a little bit, or I really need to step in and I need to treat that weed because that's going to be a problem down the road.
Yeah,
you always are given audibles and choices and decisions to make. Sometimes the plan's good, but don't be afraid to deviate from the plan because there's always something that you can do.
I had the corn planter ready for April. Daughter's softball team won a couple tournaments, so we continued playing. So now I'm in May. Oh, I'm going to do soybeans. Well, guess what? It was way too wet. Now we're into June. Okay, what can I plant in June? Well, you now have another plan for that. Okay, that's great. Now, but because we were late, the soybeans weren't established real well. They hadn't canopied over. So I'm rolling right into July, and I'm planting brassicas in it. So now I've got soybeans growing with brassicas underneath. And that may be all you have to do for the rest of the year.
Yeah, and that's generally sufficient enough.
It wasn't that long ago where I was of the mindset, to touch on what you said, Matt, whereas I, even myself guilty of it, where I would go in and I would say, well, the only times I can plant in the spring are mid-April to through May, and if I miss that, then I'm going to have to wait until late August. And
my hands are tied.
And, man, if I could squeak it in that first or maybe second week of September, I'll be okay. I miss that, and I'm not kidding you. This has happened. I miss that.
Done.
It's not getting. There's nothing. It's right. Dirt or it's soap. And
might as well sell the farm.
Might as well sell the farm. And it was
might
like,
as well just stay home and not even hunt.
Yeah. And that's where working closer with you guys are. Where it's like, hey, do a little research, talk to the right people, consult with the right people, and you can, like you said, I mean, you're talking from April till gosh dang November, there's opportunities to be productive with those food plots.
I mean, you could even dial it back and say, well, we could plant clover in February if we wanted
frost seeding. Sure. Exactly right.
So it's not
exactly
really
right.
Celebrate the holidays and get right back to planting. That's what we're saying.
I bet you, in most places across the country, we're talking about a growing season or a planting season in relation to food plots is 9 or 10 months.
Yeah,
it's not two windows, spring and fall. It's 9 or 10 months on the calendar.
So, you know, maybe food plot week turns into food plot months.
Year.
Right? Food plot year.
Well, that's actually
now it's Groundhog Day. It's the same thing every year. Same thing every day.
Shameless plug. That's called a land beat on Whitetail Properties YouTube.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
We have content there all the time that is heavy into planting, food plot, and whatnot. We cover – we're doing this, right? I mean – We're going to be filming stuff next week with options on new ways to plant and what are we doing? Because it looks like we ain't getting rain. So I'm excited for
this year, though. Be sure to check out the Land Beat series on YouTube. A lot more coming forward. We've got some other stuff that's going to be dropping soon.
But we appreciate everyone here in the audience, and we appreciate everyone listening
from
home,
too. And the constant
too.
Planes flying over, that's been a nice touch.
Absolutely.
They probably can't hear.
We got plenty of equipment to go play on. I think
I'm ready to go play on some green.
And I've been hearing about these ribeye
sandwiches. Yeah, buddy, we'll get you fixed up. Don't worry.
All right, let's get out of here. Yeah.